You are listening to a Campfire Firecast.
When the revolution comes, it will start here. That's a quote from The Guardian's Let's Move To feature, and they're talking about Frome, the independent-minded Somerset market town that I moved to last December. Everywhere you look, it would seem, the town's in the spotlight, with Harper's Bazaar magazine describing it as the UK's most stylish town, and the Sunday Times suggesting the town has reinvented itself as an artsy, foodie, hipster haven. Best of all, perhaps, local writer from Devizes, Darren Warrow, sees funky freewheeling Frome's organised community as creating a distinctiveness and liberal attitude which makes Brighton look like North Korea. This is the latest Firecast from Campfire Convention, and I'm Pete Lawrence. It was my pleasure to renew acquaintances with writer Chrissy Morrison, one of the first people I met in the town, and who's spent months putting together a definitive and enormously readable book about the town's history, heritage, the people who've made it what it is, and its passion for nonconformist creativity, which of course comes in many shapes and sizes. It's a fascinating read and a vibrant place to live, and her book Frome Unzipped is its essential guide. So listen up for Chrissy Morrison.
When I was asked to write this book was a time when there was a lot of dissent bursting out in the town and a lot of anger at the London people claiming credit for things that Frome people thought had been better before. I mean, that was the phrase that really intrigued me, because I came in 1987 and I loved it. But I sort of assumed everybody was quite glad that it had, you know, improved in many ways, as I thought. So the idea that the people who born and bred here actually felt not only resentful of the incomers claiming credit, but also resentful of the changes. I just wanted to find out more, you know, and when I started researching, I realised that this whole dissent thing is actually inbuilt into the town. I mean, the Romans never stayed here, so we never had a fort, we never had armies here, we never had a castle, a palace, never even had a university or a further. We didn't have a proper further education college. We had a department that died in about 1989, I think. So really, there was no kind of apex. There was no feeling of looking up to something or nothing to kind of alter the way the egalitarian culture was going. And it was from the very beginning, I felt that Frome Town belonged to the people. And any theory that was that other people had done something better was going to bring out the dissent in the paving stones, as it were, or the cobbles, I should say.
It's one of the common views that I think you take issue with, and I think George Monbiot actually reflected on describing it back in the 70s or 80s as dreary and buttoned down, and I think that seems to be upsetting a few people in the fact that there was a lot of vibrancy in the town anyway, but...
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, and I think the fact that it was Monbiot, people picked up on it more because he's so respected and he's had a lot to do. He's supported us a lot. You know, even the article it was in was a supportive Frome. It was supportive of the doctor who started Compassionate Frome. And the fact that he just did this throwaway remark that just chimed with all the obnoxious articles everybody had resented, you know, I think that made people talk about it more.
So you talk about this resentment. I mean, I had a quick look through some. Your book is full of great quotes, and I'll probably throw a few of those at you.
Yeah, and they're very, they're just very thrown off, because in the end, it's a short column and it gives house prices. That's what upsets people, that it's actually encouraging people to sell up their, you know, I think one of the Frome locals said, they'll sell a small house in Peckham for £1 million, come down here, buy a posh house and have loads of money to swan around with. And, you know, they don't mix with the town. They make their own little world and impose it on the town. So that was the kind of feeling I was getting from a lot of people. And I think also a lot of the quotes are quite ridiculous. I mean, there was one just after I finished the book, was, "Is Frome the most woke town?" You know, and then it went into a big thing about what woke was, which is quite funny, really. But it's on the line of all the other kind of quips that were made about Frome being ahead of itself in quite trivial ways, you know. Frome being a place to be because of the hipsters, because of the you know, because you can take your dog out to the independent market.
But I think you summed it up quite nicely, where you sort of describe a lot of these descriptions as bite-sized tips for the canny investor.
Well, yeah. Well, that's what they're aimed at. You know, they come in the financial supplements. You know, they're not really cultural. And what I discovered, which I hope I've shown through the book, is that everything that happened has had antecedents. You know, the independent market, which is great, and I don't knock it. I hope people notice. But it came from a long time ago when I first came to Frome. There was a medieval street fair up Catherine Hill, which before I came had been investment in terms of culture in Catherine Hill by people like Faye Goodrich and Lawrence Parnell, and they did a croft on the hill, and that became Made in Frome, which went out to travelled with that, and it sort of set up not only the idea of Frome as a revived artisan culture, but also the idea that you can have little festivals. And then when they brought it back to Frome, there was kind of like a ready-made arts festival. And the first festival that we had before the Frome Festival was out One World, by John Evans set it up. And that was beautiful. It was all about, it was had lovely, real ideals and great bands. And so that was sort of everything that we think of as having coming from London. Great that Londoners had the interest and to support, but the energy was there.
Yeah, I think One World was when I first became familiar with Frome, and obviously early days of the cheese and grain, seeing it on gig sheets, etc.
Yes.
The One World was a victim of the Princess Diana Death Weekend.
Yes, it was. But I mean, John Evans actually had the right to. He had a bit of paper to say that he could do what he wanted with the cheese and grain. And what he did was clear out all the rubbish, get bands there, get things going. At which time the town council thought, this is a good idea, and they took it back off him. He doesn't bear any resentment, you know, but he's got the document that shows he started it. And I think that's all the book's trying to say, you know, other people started things. Isn't it great they kept going?
Mm. I think you sum up at the end talking about creativity and dissent as being possibly the two key threads which run through Frome. I mean, also there's the element of altruism. I guess there's... Somebody described a strong commitment to helping those who need support was one of the quotes, and that very much runs through my experience of Frome.
And it runs through the book. You're quite right. I didn't mention it again at the end, but I mean, it's one of the first buildings here. Was the predecessor to the Blue House that was set up to look after the sick and the old, and the Blue House was then built on that place because that's where people were going to for support and help.
And quite a history for the street I live in, Ashley Street, which do you want to say a bit about that?
Well, that's where there were squatters, and they some of them came from communes around just to support the whole clash about Trinity. I mean, any kind of local clash is quite fun for squatters, isn't it? And I didn't know this, but I got this from the papers down at the museum. I had a lot of help from Brian at the museum. He fished out all the right papers and stuff. Let me pore over them for hours, because that period of history was one I did get from the papers, because that was week by week. There was different attitudes, and it finally came to, you know, like some couple of people in Bristol were writing about what ought to be happening, and the local people were all furious, people in Bristol telling us what to do. But attitudes were changing, and the squatters came in to support the changed attitudes, and they left. One guy, I haven't named him, but he's... I've talked to him. He left his commune and bought a little house, and you know they're now in the town as part of the townsfolk.
Would you say there's still less tension now, or more tension between the people you describe as the blow-ins, or are locally described
there's
as the blow-ins?
Definitely more tension now. I mean, that's one thing. I didn't think of that when I started writing the book, because I'd come from London and I'd been just completely integrated into the culture, and everyone I knew came from somewhere. I hadn't even made a distinction when I started between people born here and people who'd arrived. And I found I had to, because it was there. It was becoming a theme of the book, how the people in the town who were born and bred in the town were feeling about the people coming in. You know, it was becoming something I couldn't ignore. And I went and re-met my old neighbour, because I've moved and he's moved, and spent a very happy afternoon remembering the old days, and also talking about, I said, you know, you weren't like that me when I came. And he said, no, this is a new thing. We call them blow-ins now. Because I loved it when I think I put in the book. When I went to Devon, where my mother had moved to, Grockles. I was called a Grockle. When I went to Cornwall, I was called an Emmett. When I came to Somerset, I was just a human being, you know. It was wonderful. But that had changed, and my old neighbours confirmed it had changed, and a couple of other people I spoke to confirmed that, Froome people.
And that's very much fuelled by gentrification, I guess, more than anything else. House prices going up because of all these wonderful bite-sized reviews.
I think it's the house prices. I mean, I think gentrification is what people can see around them, but I think it's the house prices and the rentals on the shops that are frightening people. Because, I mean, if you think about it, kids have had jobs in town all the time they've been growing up and going to Froome College, expecting to work in town. They find, unless they're prepared to live with their parents in the spare room all their life, they can't, because they can't afford to buy. They can't afford to have families here. And so many people are moving out to less popular towns just so that they can live, really. Mm. And there's a lot of resentment at that.
One quote I've got from your book, Darren Warrow, no surprises living in Devizes. Yeah. So he lives in Devizes.
Yes, he does. Yeah. He doesn't know he's in the book, actually. I hope he doesn't mind. But, I mean, I got it offline, so it was in the public domain. But I thought it was really funny, the piece he wrote.
Froome is not a constant free festival, nor hippie commune, but an organised community acting upon issues, often against conformity, to create a distinctiveness and liberal attitude which makes Brighton look like North Korea. And that's a very recent quote, isn't it?
It is, it was last year. Yeah. But I thought, as you've noticed, if anyone reading the book will notice, I try to make it not all my voice, so it's got as many voices as I could cram in. And I thought it was good to get a close outsider, who's obviously, being a journalist, he knows a lot of what's going on. And he does a neat little summary. And it's quite witty, isn't it?
It is. And there's a wealth of stories, and some of the characters you describe really come alive. You know, you talk about Catherine Hill and how that was quite derelict and gradually took shape, and the people who were the prime movers behind it.
Yeah.
So it's very good to hear those actual case stories.
And they were all people I didn't know. You know, I had to kind of email them and say, I want to meet you and talk to you and put you in a book. And, you know, that was... It was great. It was quite nerve-wracking at first, but then people were so nice. I kind of got more confident with it, and I really enjoyed that side of it. The thing was, when I did the transcript, once I'd chosen the chunk I was going to use, I felt I had to email them to check.
So how long did it take you to write the book?
6 months.
It's quite quick, really, given the wealth of information.
Yeah, I thought I could do it in 4, but it was... ridiculous, really, because I had to read quite a bit, and research does take time, doesn't it? And then when I met the people and talked to them, you know, then I had about 80 to 100 transcripts, and it was, you know, it was just like doing a jigsaw, and more like doing a jigsaw than writing a book, and that's what took the time, working out. But I'd already got the story arc. I knew the way I wanted to do it.
Do you want to say a bit more about your writing in general? And
well, that's the first non-fiction book I've done. I have written a lot of articles in the past, and I've written some education books for MacDonald, and I've written 2 novels back in the day. I would say, to be absolutely honest, in the day when it was a bit easier to get published than it is now, I wouldn't even try now. I was just pre-chicklet, so they were still actually considering women writers who weren't chicklet, you know, after that. All went to hell in a handcart, didn't it? And I used to write stories. Travel articles, which is when I met... I think I wrote about... I used to write about Greece quite a lot, because going to Greece, you know. And... what?
And you do a lot of online blogging. You have your
online blogging, yeah, which is just what I recommend every writer to do, just to, you know, just to work at their voice. It's just writing practice, isn't it?
Yeah.
You take your journal and you shape it up into something that's a bit more edited. And plays, that's right. Oh, and poetry.
And photography.
But the plays are the big thing until I got into plays. I had several short plays put on in Bristol and then two longer ones, which was nice.
Another thing that struck me about Froom is the number of sort of alternative therapists and that sense of people really tuning into the natural world and sense of well-being, which is much more accentuated here than any place I've ever lived before.
Absolutely.
What do you think has caused that? I mean, you also refer to, you compare and contrast with Glastonbury and Totnes as well.
Yeah.
I think you described Glastonbury as a little bit too flower power and Totnes as very worthy. I mean,
well, I think those were towns that themed themselves because they thought that was their thing. I think Froom has only ever, partly because it's so dissenting really, it's only ever thought of, it's got emotional honesty is what I would call it. It is what it is, you know, and I think that allows for massive diversity. Because, you know, you do get the people, the born and bred in Froom, who sort of send up the hipsters, you know, like the band that was on in the Griffin, and they posted a notice about it that's in the book, and I can't remember it well enough to quote, but it was written in very flowery, gentrified terms, and people was checking out, they were scribbling on it, hope this isn't for real, and things like that. So it doesn't take itself too seriously, but it is quite permissive, I think.
And who's behind the Make Froom Shit Again? Is that the name of the campaign?
Yeah, I don't know. I could have found out, but I didn't want to be I wanted to just show trends.
You talk about a specific instance of someone who's a shop owner, I think, in Bath Street, who's had to move out. So there's another example, I suppose, of
exactly.
the rents going up.
That was so sad, because I think I put in the book, when I sent the transcript to him, and he had said, I'm really sad that the people with the leases, shop leases, aren't realising that this is all very precarious. The people on here nobody here is making much money. They're doing it because they love it. And if you price them out, they'll have to go. So, and when I sent him the transcript that virtually says that, he said, yeah, you can use that, but I should tell you that since I worried about that, it's happened to me and I'm having to go. Mm. So I asked him if I could put that into, you know, so that's there as well. I mean, that's just in a couple of months.
And the spirit of independence, certainly in the political end of things, is quite staggering, really. Froom is really leading the way in many respects with its independent council.
Yes.
But there seem to be conflicts, certainly, with Mendip Council. It's interesting that it's so progressive here, and yet we're surrounded by a sea of conservatism. Mm.
That was one of the first points that was made to me. Martin Dimery was one of the early people I interviewed. And
he was the person who invented Frexit.
Well, the quote that he gave me about his concern about being a Green Council and realising how isolated Froom is fitted my introduction, which was about how I was surprised when I came from London to find how isolated Froom was in Somerset. So it was sort of already there because I wrote the introduction quite early on because it gave me my story arc. And then as I was coming to finish it off, you know, here's all this explosion of and threatened Frexit and everything. So a bit more of his interview went in and he was okay with that, you know.
So do you want to say a bit more about where the Frexit thing has come from and what the tensions are between the two?
Well, I think it's just become too difficult for my, sort of in ordinary terms, when people complain about what the town council is doing, more than half the time the town councils will say, actually, that's not us, it's Mendip. You know, that hedge that you're complaining is blocking the road, we're not allowed to touch that because that's a bit of Mendip land. That kind of thing, at that ordinary level of inconvenience not being understood, is happening all the time. But at a much bigger level, Mendip, I'm sure they're doing a lot of worthy things, but they're not aware of where Froom's at in any way at all. Or they're only aware, I suppose, they've got to tamp it down, maybe, I don't know. But it doesn't make sense, really, that the Froom Town Council has had to buy back so many things that were taken from them when it all split into three. and they're sort of slowly buying things back, and then they keep finding they can't do things because Mendip still owns it, and have they got the money to buy that bit back and then see what they're doing? You know, really, the idea would be just to sort of make a separation from the tripartite thing that's happening at the moment. And that is very much politicians would have to work it out properly.
Certainly the reason for me moving here, I was very inspired by hearing Peter McFadden talking on the 38 Degrees meetings he was doing in Lewes and Brighton, and I got talking to him. And as you know, him and Annabelle organised the campfire events at the Rye Bakery, where I met a lot of great people. So that was my particular trajectory, even though I was camped up outside the Horse and Groom at East Woodlands in my camper van, which I lived in for 11 months. But it was great to arrive here a week before Christmas.
That's great.
But Peter's been very instrumental.
Peter is terrific. He's a terrific friend. He's helped me through a lot of difficult times.
And very much.
And Annabelle.
Going out there, talking about the experience of Froome elsewhere as well, which I think is something other people are learning from as well. And the book Flatpack Democracy has become quite iconic.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that I could have put more about in the book, but because they're out there already, I didn't. In the same way, in the creative chapter, I was thinking that a lot of my friends, I could say a lot more about what they do because it's so interesting. But I didn't want to weight it too much. And if things are accessible, I'd rather steer people to look up more themselves.
You mentioned Froome had its own currency at one point. It was a bit like the Letts scheme.
It was called Letts.
Was it?
Yeah, it was called Letts, but it was it was going when I came, and I definitely bought into it straight away.
And what attracted you to Froome initially?
Well, it was a weird story that I think could be... It was a Froome story. I was working in London, but I was working in a house that went with the job. I loved the job, but I knew I couldn't stay there forever. And it was working with behavioural difficulties, teenage boys, and it was quite tough. So they gave you a house on the site, because, you had to be... The boys had to be on the site most of the time. And I realised that I couldn't afford to live in London, and I didn't want to wait until I was pensionable and not be able to live anywhere. But I couldn't see how I could leave without having a job. And then my ex-husband, who I'm still very close with, because we've got boys together and, we never fell out, really, we just changed lifestyles, he was wanting to sell a house in Froome, and it was £32,000. And I thought, my God, you couldn't get a shed in London for this. And so I bought it, and I was pretty confident I'd get a job when I came down here. And the confidence was completely unfounded, because I thought, having always lived in cities, I thought there'd be public transport all around Somerset. And in fact, as soon as I got here, I realised I could only work where I could walk to, because I didn't drive at the time. And a job popped up at Froome College with, not behavioural difficulties, but learning disabilities, which I was also equipped to take. So, and again, it was a further education course. So I just walked into it. It didn't cross my mind it was going to be anyone else's job. And I think that's a real Froome story, because Froome does that. It just shows you the end of the rainbow when you need it.
And another quote I'll throw at you from Faye Goodridge about artists and the importance of artists. You talk a lot about just the incredible creativity in the town. Artists turn places around. Look at St Ives. It's the creative energy that does it.
Yes. Well, according to her, that's what did it. That's what brought the artists to the... They could afford the places on Catherine Hill, even though it was a bit ropey. And so that was what did it. And so, which, back to the worry about them being priced out now. Because people won't keep coming if the prices keep going up.
How do you see all this unfolding? Who will be moving to Froome? How will it look in 5 or 10 years' time?
Well, you can't kill the spirit.
And there's certainly plenty of spirit here. Anything else you want to say?
No, thank you for asking.
Thanks, Chrissy.
You have been listening to a Campfire Firecast.